Track 1, Renishaw Car Park.
Hello, my name's Geraint Coles. I work for the Chesterfield Canal Partnership. We're involved in restoring the Chesterfield Canal from Chesterfield right the way through to West Stockwith on the River Trent, a distance of 46 miles. The walk we're going to go on today is slightly shorter, and it's going to take us through 500 years of local history here in northeast Derbyshire.
If you'd been here less than 50 years ago, you would have witnessed a very different scene. Keep listening and take the second path on the right to follow the Transpennine Trail towards Staveley and Chesterfield.
We're going to walk up the hill and through the site of the old Renishaw Central Station. This was on the Great Central Route from Sheffield through to London and would have seen thundering expresses powering through here during the 1890s and 1900s. The line itself declined quite rapidly in the 1960s and the last trains ran through here in the 1980s. The route has been converted into an all-purpose, all-weather trail called the Transpennine Trail, which in theory links up with other paths across Europe, and you can walk from Chesterfield or from Hull or from Liverpool right the way through Europe to Istanbul.
Our journey is a modest 4.5 kilometres. Please give yourself a couple of hours to complete this relatively level walk. So, when you reach the White Road Bridge, pause and take a look at the plaque.
The station itself sat on the overbridge you see in front of you. It was brick-built and had a wooden frame. It was an extremely busy place, with siding stretching off to the colliery at Renishaw Park and to another colliery at Renishaw itself. There are also sidings connecting to the local ironworks, the extremely ancient Renishaw ironworks.
It is there that we will now head. Don't pass under the bridge. Instead, turn left to join the canal towpath and head away from the road. Can you see where the Chesterfield Canal also ran under the bridge? Listen to track 2 when you reach the black and white metal footbridge which crosses the canal. Track 2, Renishaw Ironworks.
As you're walking along the towpath, you'll see on your right-hand side a new housing estate. This is Heritage Park. It sits on the site of Renishaw Ironworks. This whole valley, clustered around a stream known as the Smithy Brook, which maybe gives you a clue as to what was going on, was being used for iron smelting as early as 1200, when there are records of the local monks running foundries and ironworks here. Certainly it was important enough that by Elizabethan times, good Queen Bess nationalised the ironworks in order to provide iron and iron fittings for her new navy. So part of the maritime strength of Britain comes from this site, almost as far from the sea as you possibly can get. The ironworks were sufficiently important that it was one of the main subscribers to the building of the Chesterfield Canal. They needed the canal to transport finished products, but they also needed it to bring in iron, iron ore, and coal and coke to operate the site. By the 19th century, it was a very important and flourishing location. Sadly, by the middle years of the 19th century, most of that had slipped away onto the newfangled railways. The ironworks itself went through many changes of hands, many changes of ownership. It made fortunes for the local families, including the Sitwell family, who have the famous Renishaw Hall not far from here. Eventually it ended up providing specialist steel castings for the local coal and steel working industry. That market rather faded away in the 1980s, and as a result the entire site became disused by the 1990s. Again, if you'd been here in the 1950s, you'd have seen a very different site. Large steel sheds, belching chimneys, trucks being shunted, the sounds of steam locomotives at work. It would have been a very busy and interesting location to be.
Pass under the footbridge and continue along the towpath. Listen to track 3 when you reach the end of this water-filled stretch of the canal. Track 3, Spinkhill Railway. The path on our right, which crosses the canal, heads to the village of Spinkhill.
This is on the line of the Spinkhill Railway. From about 1790 onwards, this brought coal, and more importantly iron ore, down from mines to the west of Killamarsh, about 3 miles down to both the ironworks and to the waiting narrowboats moored here on the canal. The Spinkhill Railway would not have looked very much like a modern railway. It had wooden rails, and every single wagon was drawn by a horse. The amount of coal and iron carried was relatively small, but it made a huge difference to the industrial development of this area, and it laid the foundations for the much more modern railways we see today.
This point marks the current extent of the canal restoration. The following section is in marked contrast.
The Chesterfield Canal opened in 1777, and it was engineered by James Brindley, one of the pioneers of waterways in Britain. The canal itself was very badly damaged during the 1960s and 70s, when very large amounts of foundry slag and sand and soil were poured into it to fill it in and level it out. In fact, the structure was so badly damaged that the canal you see today is almost entirely a modern reconstruction. We've had to do some large-scale engineering to ensure that the banks remain stable with all those new houses piled behind them.
Don't cross the canal. Instead, continue along the level towpath of the unrestored section, seeing if you can spot any lumps of iron slag by your feet. Listen to track 4 immediately after you carefully cross the road. Track 4, Spinkhill Wharf.
Just beyond the road is the site of Spinkhill Wharf. This is the place where local people would have picked up goods and cargo brought in by the canal boat.
Let's continue along the towpath as Geraint paints a picture of life on the Chesterfield Canal.
As you walk beyond the wharf, you'll be able to see the canal channel. Here, it's open but dry. It's not infilled with colliery waste or material from the local ironworks, and you can see that it's a broad, open, U-shaped ditch. It doesn't have a wall on either side. This is very typical of the early waterways and early canals, and it's certainly typical of Brindley in this area. You will have noticed since starting this walk that you've not passed any locks. That's because you're on the Long Pound. This was a 6-mile length of water, all at one level, and it stretched from Staveley right the way through to Killamarsh. The boatmen loved it, because they could just plod along mile after mile without any interruptions and without having to work any of the locks. Chesterfield Canal boats were quite unique to this waterway. Those of you who are old enough will remember the old-fashioned date boxes you used to get at Christmas. Plywood sides, flat bottom, rounded at either end. Well, a Chesterfield Canal boat looks like a 70-foot long by 7-foot wide giant date box. They had a small cabin at the front, a slightly larger cabin at the rear, but the cabins were flat. They didn't raise above the level of the overall deck. These boats were known as cuckoo boats, hence the name for the canal, Cuckoo Dyke. The name probably came from the fact that they stole traffic and trade from the boatmen on the River Trent, hence were the cuckoos in the nest. Most boats were crewed by a master, or number one, and a boy. The boy's job generally was to lead the horse. The boats were always horse-drawn, right up to the end of commercial carrying in the 1950s.
We'll learn more about the boating community later on. Our next stopping point is beside the first wooden kissing gate we reach. Track 5, The Coming of the Railway.
We've now reached a point where you'll notice the canal turns quite sharply to the right and heads off in a straight line, more or less due north. This is the point where the original line of the canal, built in 1777, was changed in the 1890s when a new railway line was built, the Great Central Railway, which we've already met back at Renishaw Central Station. The new line of canal heads straight and parallel to the railway line, and we're going to walk along that now. The original route of the canal winds around the hillside. We're going to come back to that later on in the walk.
Head downhill through the gate and turn right. Keep listening to Geraint as we head along the very straight cutting of the double-lined Great Central Line, now the Transpennine Trail.
The railway started life as the Manchester, Sheffield and Lincolnshire Railway, and it was renamed in 1900 as the Great Central when it opened a new through route down to London, one of the last great bold routes.
The canal, running parallel with us on the right-hand side, is the oldest founding member of the Great Central Railway. The Manchester, Sheffield and Lincolnshire Railway used it for a short time as a branch line. However, with the canal in decline before the end of the 19th century, it was put to another use.
This long, level stretch of railway was ideally suited to the construction of water troughs. Water troughs were long, thin troughs laid between the rails, which allowed steam locomotives to pick up water at speed. They'd pick up water here because they'd used so much water in the form of steam climbing out of Sheffield. The railwaymen, however, really hated picking up water from these troughs because the water came from the Chesterfield Canal, and they always reckoned it was muddy and made a mess of their boilers.
Look out for and take the small but obvious footpath on your left. This is roughly halfway between the large wooden table and bench and a second bridge that crosses over the track. Listen to track 6 after crossing the stile beside Boyley Farm. Track 6, Boyley Farm.
Boyley Farm is part of the Sitwell Estate, which owns most of the land around here. The farm itself dates back to the early 1800s, although most of the buildings you can see today were built in about the 1850s.
We are going to take a very short detour. Turn right, cross over the former railway bridge, and admire the view ahead.
We've just crossed over the railway line on a bridge built in the 1890s. We've come to the head of the bridge and we're looking over the rolling landscape down towards the line of the Park Brook and then climbing up towards the village of Spink Hill. And on the skyline, you can see on your right-hand side the spire of Spink Hill Parish Church, immediately left of that, the turrets of some of the academic buildings of Spink Hill College, and further left again, the green dome of the college chapel. Spink Hill College is a large private Catholic school which has been established in this area for about 100 years.
Return back to Boyley Farm and cross into the field, using the stile next to the one you crossed when you arrived here. It is just to the left of the farm entrance. Follow this public footpath along the right-hand side of the field, under the electricity cables, and pass through the metal field gate.
As you come through the gate and over the brow of the hill, directly ahead of you, you'll see the village of Eckington, and you'll see the prominent spire of Eckington Church to your right. The church dates back to Norman times, and it incorporates large lumps of Roman masonry and reused Roman brick and tile, suggesting that there was some kind of Roman settlement on the site well before the Normans arrived.
Continue downhill, passing a public footpath on our left, which we will take in a little while. Listen to track 7 when you reach the metal field gate in front of the bridge. Track 7, the Setcup Railway and Eckington Bridge.
If you turn round so your back is to the gate, you'll be looking at a series of mounds. You've got vegetation, lots and lots of shrubs and bushes, and lots of mounds of earth, and probably, depending on season, quite a large manure heap from the local farm. This would have been a very, very different scene in the 1780s. Beneath your feet would have been the line of the Setcup Railway. This was a tramway like the one we encountered back at the ironworks, but in this case extending from coal mines on the west side of Killamarsh through the village and leading up to the canal. It brought coal, and in some cases ironstone, down to the canal for loading onto the waiting narrowboats. That coal was taken to the local ironworks and to the local brick manufacturers. The tramway ran to your left, up the hill, and then dog-legged back onto the embankment that you can see in front of you. And that embankment was originally a series of tipping staves which would have chutes, wooden chutes, which discharged the coal into the waiting narrowboats. The whole thing was horse-drawn. If you turn round and face downhill, you'll be looking towards the village of Eckington, and you're actually looking along the line of the Setcup Railway. The railway was opened probably around about 1790, and it flourished for about 60 years, finally closing sometime in the 1850s. It survived long enough for George Stephenson, who built and designed the railway you see in front of you, which opened in 1842, to have to provide a bridge for the tramway.
As you head back up the track, can you picture the trams unloading the coal and iron ore into the cuckoo boats? The canal ran across our view, behind where the hawthorn bushes now grow. Eckington Bridge provided access to Boyley Farm. Turn right, over the stile and onto the public footpath. Here we will rejoin and follow the original course of the Chesterfield Canal. Listen to track 8 after crossing another stile. Track 8, Brindley's Embankment.
You've been walking along a line of the canal that was abandoned in 1890 when the new diversionary route parallel to the railway was constructed and opened. As a result, it preserves many of the features of much earlier canals. It's never been rebuilt or reconstructed in the way that canals were during the 1920s and 30s. So it preserves a lot of what an original Brindley waterway would have looked like. It contains many interesting features. You've just walked across a large stone-sided embankment. You can just about make it out through the trees. This is one of the largest structures on the canal and would have been constructed entirely by hand with picks, shovels and wheelbarrows. So it represents a huge amount of labour. It also represents a big change in the way of thinking about building canals. Most early canals are contour canals. They follow around the slope of the hill. Here the engineers decided that time is money, and cutting off a long meander that might have taken an hour to navigate and replacing it with a short embankment was worth the effort of building that embankment in the first place. So it represents a bit of a change in how these things are constructed, and as a result we often say that the Chesterfield Canal looks forward to the next great age of canal construction under Thomas Telford. To your left you'll see a number of semicircular areas cut into the hillside. These are the remains of the work camp, the sort of builder's yard, if you like, for the construction of the embankment. We know that there was a lime kiln on the site. We know that there were bothies to accommodate the navvies who worked here. Behind you, you'll see some rock faces. These are of the local coal measure sandstone. And rather unusually here, James Brindley has actually cut the canal into rock. He normally didn't do this, but quite clearly he could use the stone for other purposes, bridges, structures, and probably for building that stone-faced embankment which we just talked about.
Continue following the main path. Listen to track 9 when we are alongside the large pond on your right. At this point, we will learn some more about the industries that brought the canal here in the first place. Track 9, Chapel Wheel Dam.
As you're walking along, you'll see the channel of the canal to your left-hand side. To your right is a body of water. This is currently a fishing pond. It's known as Chapel Wheel Dam. And the chapel wheel itself was a grinding wheel. It grind edges in blades and produced cutlery. Most of the manufacturing in this area in the medieval period was very similar to the sort of activity you'd see in Sheffield. Lots of little owners of small grinding wheels, all doing one particular job as part of a long chain of production, starting with iron smelting, working through forging, going on to shaping, and then going on to grinding and edge finishing, and then finally going on to adding the handles and the trim. This pattern of production, the so-called little masters or little meisters, was very common throughout Sheffield and South Yorkshire and into this part of northeast Derbyshire from medieval times through to the 1800s. And it's one of the reasons the canal was built in the first place. It was these people, these owners of small businesses, who invested their money to build the canal. They knew that improved transport was the way to make their businesses a success, and they'd seen the proprietors of businesses in Sheffield investing in improving the River Don, or River Dun as it was then known, in order to make it navigable. They knew they had to have their own waterway to the sea, and in order to replace the packhorse trails which took their goods to Bawtry, they decided to build the canal to the River Trent.
Continue along the path, ignoring the track that soon crosses your path, and listen to track 10 when you reach the gate. Here you will learn more about the trading routes and the people that worked on the boats. Track 10, a gauging point.
As you approach the stile, you'll notice a path crossing from left to right in front of you. If you turn and face up the hill, looking up the path, you're looking towards Burley Farm, another one of the estate farms created in the 1800s. On your left-hand side, you'll notice some stonework poking through the vegetation. Long, parallel courses of flat sandstone. Initially, you might think it was a canal lock, but none was ever needed here, as you're in the middle of the 6 mile pound between Staveley and Killamarsh, a long, level sheet of water where no locks required. So, what was it for? The answer's money. This was a toll station. This was a gauging point. A point where you could measure out how much cargo you were carrying. A company servant would use a dipping stick to work out the depth to which a hull had sunk in the water, and based on what you were carrying, whether it was iron or coal, he would be able to work out the tonnage you were actually carrying. And of course, if you weren't travelling through a lock, you wouldn't ever pass by a lock keeper who would charge you a toll. So by having an intermediate stop like this on this long pound, they could charge tolls for even these short journeys. In some cases, the boats traded great distances. Boats would travel down the Trent to Nottingham, they'd travel along the Witham navigation to reach Lincoln, they'd even travel as far as Boston, sometimes lashing themselves together and crossing over to King's Lynn on the far side of the Wash. Boats would also trade northwards to Doncaster and to Sheffield. The vast majority of carrying, however, was local. For example, coal would be carried from a local coal mine to a local gasworks, tar would then be carried from the gasworks to a local chemical works, and then the boat would return to carrying coal to the gasworks. So they were small, daily movements of boats rather than enormous great voyages. That's how the canal earned its bread and butter, doing things on a regular basis, reliably, day after day, year after year.
Head through the gate, down the steps, and follow the bed of the canal until you reach the next gate. This is your prompt for Track 11. Track 11, a canal in splendid isolation. As Geraint Coles summarised what made the Chesterfield Canal so special, head through the gate, turn right, and then almost immediately left uphill. Turn right and follow the Transpennine Trail back to the Renishaw car park.
The route we've walked on today encapsulates something of the history of the Chesterfield Canal. The Chesterfield Canal was one of the earliest canal navigations to be built in the United Kingdom. It was finished 2 years before the famous Iron Bridge at Iron Bridge Gorge was constructed. And that's often seen as the start of the Industrial Revolution, but the news is that here in northeast Derbyshire, it was well underway before that. The Chesterfield Canal grew out of the ambitions of Chesterfield and northeast Derbyshire merchants, ironmasters, glassmakers and chemical manufacturers to have access to wider markets through shipping their products down the Trent to the Humber and out into the North Sea. And products made throughout this area were found as far afield as Finland, Sweden, the Netherlands, Spain and France. The Chesterfield Canal always did things differently. The communities along it stood apart from the villages with which they were associated. The people who lived in them were different. They were more like fishing villages marooned in the centre of England than any normal, common-sense farming or mining community. The men didn't go away in the morning and come back in the evening. They went away in the morning and came back 3, 4, 5 weeks later, just like fishing villages. And when they did, they brought back a bit of brass in their pocket. The end result was almost inevitably a little bit of drunkenness and probably a bit of violence. But these were different communities. They stood apart. They were proud and different. The Chesterfield Canal was the last waterway to be designed by James Brindley, the so-called father of English canals. He was responsible for the first true canal in England, the Bridgewater Canal, which ran from Worsley Delph, just outside Manchester, into Manchester, transporting coal. He designed the waterway route, but unfortunately he died while he was out surveying, having caught a chill and eventually developing pneumonia. The work was finished by his two assistants, John Varley and Hugh Henshaw. And unfortunately, the two men did not get on. They were chalk and cheese. And on many occasions, there are records of them meeting up at inns halfway between different work sites, having blazing rows and then riding off in opposite directions. But in spite of these personal differences, the canal was finished in 1777. It's probably the finest example of one of the early waterways in the UK. It certainly contains some of the most novel and innovative engineering features. It also struck a bold route. It crossed across the grain of the country. It didn't follow the valleys, but climbed up hills and tunnelled through them and then came out the other side. And in many respects, its route is much more like that of a railway line than of a canal. Much more direct and much more pointed. So this is a spectacular, early and important canal. And it's one that's been really underrated and undervalued in the history of waterways in the United Kingdom. Probably because it doesn't connect directly with the other Midlands canals. It's always been off to one side, the Cuckoo Dyke running from Chesterfield through northeast Derbyshire, through Nottinghamshire, to the River Trent, in splendid isolation.